Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Like millions of Black Americans, my grandparents migrated from the southern states of America, in our case, Mississippi, and moved throughout the nation in search of a better life. It was a stunning shift for our country. Over six decades, this massive migration, known as the Great Migration, shaped the economic, demographic, and cultural landscape of our nation as we know it today. Author Blair Imani chronicles this moment in history in her new book, Making Our Way Home, The Great Migration and the Black American Dream. And she joins us now to talk about it. And Blair, there have been other books on the Great Migration, Isabel Wilkerson's The Warmth of Other Suns, for example. But your book is different in that it looks and reads sort of like a graphic novel. Why did you decide to write it this way?
Well, I really, myself, am someone who likes to envision things. And I think it's important that the predominant folks in the book are folks who are brown-skinned Black people, when myself being a light-skinned Black person, really thinking about how privilege shows up in the way that we even depict Black stories. So, for example, I talk about colorism throughout the book and talk about things like passing for white, etc. But instead of depicting those people, because we often see folks who look like me, I wanted to show a wide array of Black folks who are brown-skinned, who come from different backgrounds, and not just celebrities either, but everyday Black people. So that's really where I was coming from. But, you know, at a basic level, I think that a book with illustrations is more approachable to a wider audience. And I wanted to make sure this got into the hands of as many people as possible.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit more. You know, I could see this being used in schools. Was that your intention?
Absolutely. You know, I didn't have Black history really robust in my schools. I had kind of like home teaching in terms of Black history, where my parents would kind of complement whatever I was learning in school. And I've seen my younger cousins' history books, and they're more robust in terms of representation. But how honest are they? And I think that's really the thing to interrogate. And so I have a glossary in the back of the book, so that way everything is kind of laid out in a way that's approachable again. And it's written at about a fifth or sixth grade level, which is what most Americans' reading level is at. And so that being said, I just wanted to make sure it was accessible.
Talking more about the content of the book, you write that you would often joke that thanks to this incomplete history, it felt like Black people kind of disappeared from the face of the earth during World War I and World War II, only to return with music and afros and righteous indignation in the late 50s, that basically we learned very little about what happened after slavery and before the civil rights movement. I mean, was that like at the core of writing this book? What led you to want to talk about that particular space and time?
Just the fact that so much happened and so little is written. I remember being in an American history course, even in college, and we, you know, did our chapter on the 1920s, and there was no mention on the Harlem Renaissance. And so, like, I was looking at the syllabus and I was like, oh, clearly I've missed something. Like, there's no way that the teacher omitted this. Maybe there was like a class that I missed or something. And I went to the teacher and he was like, oh, I guess that's important. And I was like, I guess, you know, like you're teaching to a predominantly in a predominantly Black neighborhood. You know, Baton Rouge is a majority Black city. And yet the attendance at Louisiana State University, where I attended, was about 12%. So clearly there's a gap, you know, and it's showing up in the curriculum. And also the fact that as I was doing the research for this book, I'm realizing that, hey, if 40% of farm workers at this time period during the Great Depression were Black people, why are all the stories that we hear, like Grapes of Wrath, you know, Dust Bowl, different documentaries, why are they only focusing on these white folks? So it was just kind of those things where it's like, okay, I thought I was aware of all the gaps, but there's even more.
Yeah. One thing that was really striking for me in this book as well was the framing. I mean, oftentimes the framing is shaped by hardship and suffering, but you really want it to tap into as well some of the things that we celebrate about our culture and the people that we celebrate. And I want to talk more about that, but I want to talk about your family and your family's reasoning for moving from the South to LA. Tell us a little bit about your own family story.
So I remember one night when I had brought over all my American Girl dolls to my grandmother's house, and she was looking at the story of Addie, who was one of the, I think, only Black American dolls that they have in that series.
Back then when you were younger.
Yeah, when I was younger. And so I was telling her about Addie's story, And then she starts telling me about her own, which happened in around the 1930s. You know, she was born in 1929. And she starts telling me about how my great-grandfather had to collect all of his belongings and flee because there was a lynching in their city in Little Rock, Arkansas. And the Klan had basically, you know, lynching is a form of mass intimidation. And in this particular case, the Klan said, and if any slur goes to work tomorrow, you'll be dead, just like this one. And my great-grandfather, and everyone says I'm so much like him, he decides to go to work the next day because he's not going to be intimidated. He has a family to provide for. So he goes into work. The owner of the store where my great-grandfather works, he gets word that my great-grandfather is going to be killed. And he doesn't want to see that happen. It was a white man. And he gave Big Daddy his car and he said, get out of here. Like, go, just go. And it wasn't like you could just pick up and leave, you know?
He had a family.
He had a family. And it was this big moment of, does he leave or does he stay and does he die? And that could be the end of the story right there. But he picks up and he leaves. And it was really kind of a community coming together, people cooking and making sure that his car was full of food, making sure that his family would be taken care of because they had to get out of that house regardless of whether or not my great grandmother or my grandma could go with him.
Yeah.
So they basically evacuated, spread the family out. And that's why we live in Pasadena because he came out to Pasadena. And so it's really difficult to talk about. But I wanted to open the book with that story because it's why I'm here. And that's profound.
Okay, now I want to get to the joy that we see in this book. So many of the stories of the cultural contributions of Black Americans in film, music, and literature, there's so many in this book. How difficult was it for you to balance both the beautiful and the ugly? But then also with the beautiful, there's so many stories. How did you choose them?
Well, I think, you know, that's even the chapter title of chapter two, Beautiful and Ugly Too, which is a line from Langston Hughes' essay, The Negro Artist in the Racial Mountain. And the 1920s really exemplifies this and was a great starting place for me because there's a lot of research and a lot of chronicling of what happened during the Harlem Renaissance, but it often omits LGBTQ contributions. So I was like, okay, well, it's time to queer the Harlem Renaissance and really talk about how the first magazine that was created by Black and LGBTQ people and folks of those intersections was called Fire, and it was created in 1926.
Blair, can I say something?
Yes.
You know, as a child reading about the Harlem Renaissance, there was always an inkling that am I missing another part of this story? And it was the LGBTQ story. That was the story that was missing.
And I talk about how it was like this point at which it was crucial for Black folks to cast off every element that white society had thrust upon us, including heteronormativity and gender expectations. And I wanted to lift that up. But then also it was a time where lynching and violence was really peaking, the nadir of American history in terms of race relations. So Beautiful and Ugly Too speaks to that, that there's so much beauty happening in the 1920s in particular, but so much ugliness. And then throughout the book, it was really difficult to kind of zero in on moments that were crucial. But I also, you know, kind of going to distribution of privilege, I wanted to talk about how Sidney Poitier and Harry Belafonte were contemporaries, for example. But because of colorism, Harry Belafonte was imbued with more desirability. And so instead of depicting him in the book, I decided to depict Sidney Poitier, and also uplift how Ebony was kind of one of the few magazines that were depicting people, and how even though these movies were happening in black and white, Dorothy Dandridge was lifted up higher than, you know, some of her darker hued sisters, and how Lena Horne even spoke to this.
Yeah.
So I thought of how I could add to existing conversations that folks are more in touch with in terms of black pop culture, and look at how I could contribute to that space by deconstructing it, by looking at it from an LGBTQ lens, from a privilege lens, looking at it from classism and colorism, and dive into that.
Blair, you mentioned wanting to queer the Harlem Renaissance. In fact, there are stories of members of the LGBTQ community throughout the book. For example, you have Bayard Rustin, the openly gay civil rights activist who was excluded from speaking at the March on Washington. These stories were important for you to tell.
Oh, absolutely. You know, myself, I'm a bisexual Black Muslim woman, and, you know, I have some skin in the game, clearly. But I think, too, it's important to show other folks. You know, I remember explaining to my parents why the bathroom bill in North Carolina mattered to them and how, you know, bathrooms were segregated by race and they are now segregated by gender, and how social categorization is harmful to everyone. And so it really became important to me not only to include, but also to elevate. You know, Barbara Jordan was a lesbian, you know, that's important. Because there's such a conversation now that says, oh, this is a new phenomenon. Oh, this has come out of nowhere. This is novel. It's a trend. That's what I hear often from older folks is that it's a trend. But it's not. It's, yeah. You know, it's part of Black history. It's part of American history.
And it seems you were intentional in conveying this message, even in the artwork.
Oh, yeah. So there's this fun little Easter egg. If you look at the cover, you know, at the binding, you have my Uncle Lester. You have a partner that we've given him. He came out later in life. He was a gay Black man, but he never got to live his life out and openly because of social climates. And so we gave Uncle Lester a partner. Right in the center, you have my great aunt, my great uncle, Clarence and Carmen. And at the end, you have myself and my partner, myself being a queer woman and Uncle Lester being at the end. And I think that's a nice bookend to have. And I just love the idea of people picking up this book because they love Black history, but then also realizing that they have a gay couple on the front of this book. And it shows that we are of diverse and multifaceted people and all of our stories matter.
Blair Imani's book is Making Our Way Home, The Great Migration and the Black American Dream. Blair, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.